Hi, my name, as you said, is Travis Eliadis. I'm an epidemiologist at the British Columbia Center for Disease Control in Vancouver. And my presentation loads. Does it look the same to you? I guess I have to do something here. That one. There we go. Okay, so I'm very grateful to be here, and I'm here on behalf of a number of colleagues in Vancouver as well as our collaborators at the Public Health Agency of Canada. Since I'm the last presenter and we're at the end of the conference, I'm going to take a gamble and assume you've all heard about the history of drug-resistant gonorrhea. So I won't say a lot about it, just get on to my results because I'm more excited about them anyway. But really just to say that over the last 80 years, we've seen the sequential loss of a series of classes of drugs to treat gonorrhea due to resistance, which is informative from a historical context, but also sort of raises the question, when will we see the emergence of resistance or establishment of resistance to our current first-line treatments? I will highlight the one part of the background, which is how we treat gonorrhea in Canada. So in the context of having to change drugs constantly, we've been also in Canada reviewing and revising our treatment guidelines. For the data I'm going to present today, the most relevant recommendations are those from 2006 to 2011, and at that time in Canada, we recommended preferentially using cefixime 400 milligrams for all gonorrhea. In British Columbia, we did have a recommendation to co-treat with doxycycline, and I'll highlight then that starting just at the very tail end of December 2011, the new recommendation is for preferential use of ceftriaxone for all gay men and other men having anal or oral sex, and for pharyngeal infections at all, regardless of gender or sexual orientation. And then 800 milligrams of cefixime for all other gonorrhea cases, and co-treatment with azithro for all gonorrhea cases. Okay, so for those of you not familiar with the geography of Canada, it's okay, I'm an American and I know how it goes. So I'll situate you. British Columbia is the westernmost province. We border four US states, so we're very relevant. We're like the California of Canada. And our provincial lab in Vancouver has been doing antimicrobial resistance, or AMR, testing since 1991, with testing for cephalosporins and azithromycin since 2006. Many of you will know that Western North America was the first region to see the emergence of resistance to quinolones in the 1990s, so it's a very important region for surveillance of drug-resistant gonorrhea. We had a few kind of overarching questions in doing this analysis. First of all, we wanted to know what were recent temporal trends in reduced susceptibility of gonorrhea to our first-line treatments. We also wanted to know how susceptibility differed by site of infection, and we were interested in this for two reasons. One, you noticed on the previous slide that in Canada we're now preferentially recommending ceftriaxone for pharyngeal gonorrhea, so we wanted to know if we could back up that recommendation in our data. But also because we do not, I'm presenting lab data, and so we don't have linked information about sexual behaviors. So we wanted to stratify by gender and site of infection as a proxy for sexual networks of gay men. And then third, because we do not have a sentinel system as you have in the U.S. for surveillance of gonorrhea, drug-resistant gonorrhea, we wanted to know what were the limitations of our passive continuous sampling system. Basically, how far could we stretch our data? What could we learn from this? And what would be the additional value of investing in a sentinel system? And then, as well, sort of once we've stretched our data as far as we can, what other studies do we need to do to investigate some of these hypotheses? Our provincial public health lab does 15 to 20% of all gonorrhea diagnostic testing for the province. And two-thirds of those specimens are coming from public STD clinics that we operate in Vancouver, as well as their outreach programs. AMR testing at the provincial lab is routine for all gonorrhea that's diagnosed by culture, as well as isolates that are forwarded in from other community or hospital-based labs. And the assay they're using is the E-test assay, which is fairly standard. For those of you not familiar with the test, it produces an MIC, or a minimum inhibitory concentration. This is the lowest concentration of the drug that's required to inhibit growth of the bacterium, and it basically serves as a laboratory proxy for reduced susceptibility in vivo. So we looked at a whole panel of drugs, those with that are now obsolete, including, and then also our first-line treatments. So for penicillin, tetracycline, and ciprofloxacin, we used the established MIC breakpoints that are shown here. And for the rest of the presentation, I'm just going to collapse the resistant and intermediate resistant categories. And then for cefixime, ceftriaxone, and azithromycin, the Clinical and Laboratory Standards Institute has not yet established thresholds for resistance, but there are working definitions for susceptibility, which are less than 0.5 for the cephalosporins and less than 2 for azithromycin. So what we did was we explored 3 serial dilutions below each of these breakpoints to identify isolates that had what we called elevated MIC. We use this as a possible marker for reduced susceptibility to the drugs. This is similar to the analysis that GISP in the US has done and published in MMWR last year, if you saw that. What else to say here? So we did a per isolate analysis, and the covariates that we looked at were whatever we could get from the lab. So date of specimen collection, site of infection, gender, and age. So from 2006 to the end of 2011, we had 1,800 isolates that were AMR tested in Vancouver. This is 200 to 500 per year, and they represent 22% of all reported gonorrhea cases in our province. Comparing in the two columns here, the 1,800 AMR tested isolates with about the 8,000 reported gonorrhea cases, there are some noteworthy differences. So specimens from males are overrepresented in the AMR tested isolates. As well, the age distribution skews slightly older. And we're also overrepresenting rectal and pharyngeal specimens. And this is not surprising, given that during this time there was a recommendation to preferentially use culture to diagnose gonorrhea in the throat and rectum. So altogether, although we don't have linked data on sexual behaviors, we think that this sample of isolates is probably heavily represents gay men and other men having sex with other men. Okay, so I'll get to the results. For all the graphs I'm showing here on out, the y-axis is percentage of isolates, either percentage of isolates that are resistant or intermediate resistant for the drugs with established resistance, and percentage of isolates with elevated MIC for the first-line treatments. So you can see in the top two panels here for penicillin and tetracycline, just like in the rest of North America, we saw the establishment of resistance to these drugs. In 2011, almost 100% of isolates were resistant or intermediate resistant. I'm showing this, though, for two reasons. First, just to illustrate the historical context for drugs with emerging resistance patterns, but also to show you the year-to-year variability, and that's not entirely unexpected. If you look at data from elsewhere, we do see some fluctuation year-to-year. And I was happy yesterday, I don't know if you saw Bob Kirkcaldy presented data from the US system, and they showed, I can't show in our data, but they showed there's even regional variation where some places it will go up or down. And you'll see why I'm interested in that in a minute. Now for ciprofloxacin on the bottom panel, you see the same pattern, although resistance has emerged more recently. And you may note that there was a drop, a slight decrease in resistance to ciprofloxacin in 2011. So just pay attention to that for now, and I'll come back to that point later. So now turning to cephalosporins, you see cefixime on the top, ceftriaxone on the bottom, and the different color shadings are different MICs, so lower MICs. The 0.064 is the lightest color, then 0.125, then on the top is 0.25. So first of all, I should say we had no isolates during the six-year period that had an MIC greater than 0.25, nor are we aware of any reported treatment failures in the province. But if we look at that MIC just below the expected threshold for susceptibility, we do see an overall trend of rising MICs, just like they've seen in the US and in Europe. And as with ciprofloxacin, we see a slight decrease in the 2011 year, although it's not out of keeping with the overall six-year trend. And you'll note that's consistent with what we saw for ciprofloxacin. So if there's time at the end, I can talk about additional analysis we've done to look at that. I should also point out that the data that's been published from the US, they're just looking at that 0.25 MIC level, whereas on this slide I was showing you the 3 serial dilutions below the threshold. So, you know, we were curious then to compare apples with apples. Just looking at the 0.25 MIC value, we see a trend consistent with what's reported in the US, somewhere in between the Midwest and Eastern regions and the Western region in the US. But we do see a rise then in 2011 for the percentage with an MIC of 0.25. Okay, now going to azithromycin, we see the same pattern of an MIC creep or gradual rise in those MICs at or just below the level of resistance, although no drop in 2011 here, that like what we saw for the cephalosporins. And I should also point out that, again, you have the same sort of gradient of shading, and most of these isolates were at that 0.5 MIC, so we're not sure of the clinical significance of that. Only 15 or 1% had an MIC of 2 or greater over the 6-year period. Okay, now stratifying by site of infection, because we're in a panel about non-genital screening. So first, looking at the drugs with established resistance, we see a consistent pattern. So the bar you're looking at on the left is at the rectal site, then throat, then urethra, and then cervix. So consistently a decrease across those sites. And when we stratify by gender, we see the same pattern, higher rates of resistance in men than in specimens coming from women, which isn't surprising given that most of our rectal and pharyngeal specimens in our sample are coming from men. Okay, now turning to cefixime, ceftriaxone, and azithromycin. Now looking at elevated MICs, we see the same pattern, highest at the rectum, then throat, then urethra, then cervix. But the gradient is larger, right? So the pattern's even more pronounced for these drugs with emerging resistance, which isn't surprising if we think that emerging bugs with the tendency toward resistance are being passed through sexual networks. We did also look at patterns by age, and elevated MIC increases with age, but I think this is probably confounded by gender, because when we restrict just to males, that trend is removed. And I'm not showing it here because of small numbers, but we did look at the throat site at further stratifying by males and females, and we saw consistently higher levels of resistance and elevated MIC among males at the throat site than among females. So to summarize, we see a consistent rise in elevated MIC to cefixime, ceftriaxone, and azithromycin over the last 6 years in British Columbia. This is superimposed on a background of established resistance to penicillin, tetracycline, and ciprofloxacin, and consistent with the MIC creep that's been reported in the US and Europe. We see a consistent disparity by site of infection, where resistance is highest for rectal and pharyngeal gonorrhea. And this disparity is most pronounced for cephalosporins and azithromycin. We interpret this as most likely representing sexual networks of gay men and other men having sex with men. And it substantiates the distinct treatment recommendations that we're using in Canada to preferentially use ceftriaxone for pharyngeal gonorrhea. There's an ongoing debate over the mechanism for the emergence of resistance to these drugs, and we're uniquely situated in BC to take a look at this because we have a population registry that captures all outpatient or community use of drugs in British Columbia, including antibiotics. So this graph is showing over the last 15 years trends in third generation cephalosporin use and azithromycin. So for cephalosporin, we see no change, or if anything, a slight decrease. So that's unlikely to explain the emergence of resistance to cephalosporins in British Columbia. For azithromycin in particular, it's been suggested that broad community use might be producing some pressure toward antimicrobial resistance. It's hard. This is ecological data. It's hard to make any causal association here. But we do see an increase from 1996 to 2005. Since then, even through 2010, although I'm not showing that here, it's been pretty stable or even a slight decrease. So hard to interpret, but it does sort of add to the data that we're looking at. And lastly, I'll mention that, you know, we were interested in deciding, so I work in surveillance, we want to know what is the value of additional investment in sentinel surveillance, and for sure in these data we do see one of the key limitations of using a passive surveillance system for this kind of question. In 2011, when we saw that dip in MICs to cephalosporins, it's hard to know, is that because of a change in the clinics and labs that are forwarding specimens, or is that a true change in the profile of resistance out in the community? Although, to be fair, we've beaten up our data quite a bit to reassure myself that it's not a change in clinics or labs sending in specimens, but that is a limitation of this kind of system. And for sure, if we had a sentinel system, having that consistent source of isolates and having linked clinical and epi data would help. So for further study, I'm really interested in this question about networks of transmission that might be passing on the isolates that have a tendency toward rising MICs for cephalosporins versus azithromycin. Do I have a minute to show one more thing? I do? Okay, sure. Good, because I think this is the most interesting part. not this, but this part. So I showed you this pattern, right, where we saw a drop in 2011, and I was really happy to see in Bob Kirkcaldy's slides yesterday that in some regions of GISP, so in Southern California, for example, they also saw a drop in elevated MICs in 2011. So I was like really relieved, like, okay, we're not weird in Canada. But we were curious, why did we see a drop for Cipro and a drop for civixime ceftriaxone, but not azithromycin in 2011. So really interesting, prior to 2011, so 2006 to 2010, we saw that Cipro resistance, I'm factoring out here penicillin and tetracycline because almost all the isolates are resistant or intermediate resistant. So, but looking prior to 2011, isolates that were resistant to ciprofloxacin, which is about half of them, were far more likely to be have elevated MIC to cefixime and ceftriaxone and azithromycin, as you might expect, right? They all kind of hang together, and I've showed the odds ratios for you here. When we get to 2011, cipro resistance continues to be associated with cefixime and ceftriaxone resistance, so odds ratios of sky high. But for azithromycin, that association is removed, and it's even an inverse relationship when we look at that those highest MICs. So in other words, there's sort of a dissociation between these patterns in 2011, where the people who have resistance to ciprofloxacin and cephalosporins are different from those who have resistance to azithromycin. So just this week, unfortunately I was here, so I couldn't look at the data, but our national lab sent us the ST types. So when I get back, I'll be really curious to see if looking at if the genotypic data, if there is some differing patterns in the data. But yeah, so that's all I got. Thanks.
Very interesting data, and it's a really nice presentation, very clear presentation.
Thank you.
Question.
Thanks.
Yep. So you all are using 800 milligrams of cefixime for non-MFM, non-pharyngeal
yes.
Cases of gonorrhea. And I wonder how you came to that and if you're having any problems with side effects.
Okay, so unfortunately, because I'm on the EPI surveillance side, I wasn't involved with coming up with these guidelines. Is anyone here from Canada? Okay. Oh, yeah, there's Roberta. Okay. Do you know? I mean, I think they wanted to, they sort of, you know, same principles as when they shifted the U.S. guidelines, they wanted to say, okay, increase dosage, use two different classes of drugs and co-treatment, and switch to different drugs for different populations. So that was sort of, those were the guiding principles. These were just recommended at, in like December 20th of 2011. So I don't think we've had enough experience yet with the 800 milligrams of cefixime to comment on side effects. But that's something for sure that we'll want to look at, and we'll look at in our STD clinic. But I do think, you know, that the idea was, you know, if possible to and there are, I guess, some issues and some pushback around the use of intramuscular ceftriaxone. So to save it for the populations where we expect to be seeing the highest levels of resistance. But yeah. Yeah, thanks.
Any other questions? Well, you've been a great audience and great speakers. So thank you all, and hope you travel safely home. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks.